Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Read with Michelle Martin on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
He started investing when he was just 19 years old, and he's built a roadmap for us all in his upcoming book, a book that talks about using money to build the life that you want and not spending your life chasing wealth. The book is titled Balance. Isn't that something we all need in life? Andrew Hallam joins me live. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation, Michelle.
Great to speak with you. I like what one of your advanced readers says in this book, and I think it sums it up beautifully. Imagine there was a multiverse where the most content, satisfied, happiest future version of yourself traveled back in time to give you the blueprint to lead a fulfilling life. That is this book. Now, before we get into some of the ideas in the book, could you help us understand your journey to building your own wealth? And was that long runway from starting investing at the age of 19 and really putting your money into low-cost ETFs, was that a big part of your journey to wealth?
Well, I started out like most people do with like actively managed funds. And I think that's what a lot of people do is they start out with an actively managed, say, unit trusts. And so when I was 19, that's what I did. I walked into a bank and that's what I purchased. And obviously there are fees associated with them. And I learned that high fees can erode long-term returns. So then I evolved to the point where I was buying individual shares. Mm. And then shortly thereafter, I was doing so much research and so much writing and recognized that it was so hard over an investment lifetime to outperform a globally diversified portfolio of ETFs on a risk-adjusted basis. And so I eventually just migrated my money into a portfolio of ETFs, and I just continued to add money, Michelle. So I never had like a really high salary. But what I did do is I consistently added money every single month, and I did that from age 19. And obviously my salary increased as I grew older, and as my salary increased, I invested more money over time. And eventually, you know, compound interest, you know, worked its magic. And I was able to build a decent sized portfolio on a relatively modest income.
So you did start with a do-it-yourself portfolio, and then your approach changed over time. What sort of concepts related to do-it-yourself investing, which I know a lot of our millennial listeners are keen on doing for themselves, and what sort of concepts on portfolio allocation do you stress in this book?
Well, the one thing that's really important is I say investing is a lot like a bar of soap. Like the more you mess with it, the smaller it gets. So you think about it in a shower. So generally speaking, when we look at research on investment returns, if you're a trader, you're moving in and out of stocks. Generally speaking, you will lose to a market tracking index over time. And you might do better than a market tracking index for a year or 2 years or 3 years. But your investment duration is your actual lifetime. It's not short term, it's long term. So as you're working, you're contributing money to your investment portfolio, you're adding to it. When you retire, you're pulling money away from your investment portfolio, you're gonna be taking money out. But the money needs to last as long as you do. So your investment duration literally is your lifetime. And when we look at peer-reviewed statistical evidence on this, the odds of beating a diversified allocation of equal risk-adjusted ETFs over your lifetime is almost an impossible thing to do. So the idea here was to pick an allocation that ends up matching your tolerance for risk. Mm. And so if you're a high-risk investor, that allocation could be something like 80% stocks and 20% bonds. If you're a lower risk investor, it could be something like 60% stocks and 40% bonds.
Where are you on options or cryptocurrencies, Andrew?
I stay away from what I call speculations. And so if it doesn't create cash flow and it has no intrinsic value, then I see it as a speculation. And so for me, if I'm purchasing a property, for example, I know that I can get cash flow from renting that property out. If I'm buying actual stocks or I'm buying an index or an ETF, it's filled with entities, corporate entities that actually have cash flow that produce, obviously, their businesses. And so over time, I know that those businesses as a group, you could take the, you know, whatever, the S&P 500 index or the Singapore stock market index, and over time on aggregate, those business earnings every 5 or every 10 years will certainly be higher, you know, just as those corporations end up making more money. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, long term, the stock prices track those actual corporate earnings plus the dividends. When I look at something like a cryptocurrency, it's really, really tough to determine what the intrinsic value is in it. And so I deem it more as a speculation. And so for me personally, I don't invest in cryptocurrency. I like to keep things really simple. I know that over my lifetime, and when we look at peer-reviewed evidence, if I keep a diversified portfolio of ETFs, I will outperform about 90% of professional investors. And so that equals hedge fund managers. It beats the typical most endowment fund managers. And some people will say, well, you know, there's that always that extra 10%. There's that group that outperforms. So if I can outperform 90% of the professional investors with a portfolio of ETFs, a lot of people will say, well, that's not good enough. I want to be in the top 10%. But the problem is, Michelle, that the top 10% during one time period isn't typically going to be the top 10% during the next time period. So I like to just, I sleep really well at night knowing that I can beat 90% of professional investors over my lifetime by just keeping things simple.
Andrew Hallam joining us live. He is the author of Balance, How to Invest and Spend for Happiness, Health, and Wealth. Andrew, how is this book different from Millionaire Teacher? And for those of you listening and thinking, who is Andrew Hallam? Well, he built his wealth and, you know, can proudly say he's a millionaire based on a teacher's salary and consistent investing over time. So what did you want to do differently in this book compared to Millionaire Teacher?
Well, the one thing, I guess, for starters, I wanted to keep one element the same, where I showed people how to build diversified portfolio of ETFs and why we would want to do that. But I wanted to look, Michelle, more holistically at money. So the idea that really when we look at what it is we want to achieve in life, regardless of what that is. So if I asked you, you wanted to run a marathon, and I asked you why you wanted to run a marathon, or you wanted a promotion, or you wanted to get a master's degree, or you wanted to raise children or raise your dog in a certain way. When we ask why, and I continue to dig with that question, ultimately people will say something like, well, it'll make me happy, it'll give me security, make me feel safe. Just about every single decision we ever make will boil down to one of those responses. So it deals with, of course, then life satisfaction.
Yep.
So our goal here is overall life satisfaction. And we could call that happiness, but happiness is kind of fleeting. You know, there are moments in time we can't be really happy all the time, but we can end up with a relatively high level of life satisfaction. And so for me, life satisfaction is success. And so then in looking at the book Balance, I wanted to look at research to determine, okay, if life satisfaction equaled success, how can we try to enhance our life satisfaction? What does the actual research say on this? And so I broke this down into four categories. One, we do need enough money, and we need to have a safe place to live. We need enough food. It's nice to have a little bit of extra money so that we can spend it on experiences, maybe a bit of travel, saving for a future. We need solid relationships. No matter how much money we have, we're not really a success if our relationships are train wrecks. We need our health. So this is really important. And it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody, you know, we need to be Olympic athletes, but we need to do what we can with the vessel that we have, because we really only have one body. And then fourth, we need a sense of purpose, something to get up in the morning, a reason to get up, a reason to be. And I think what ends up happening to a lot of people, especially people who pursue money, is that the pursuit of money can create something really lopsided. You know, through pursuing too much money, we can end up dropping the ball in a lot of other capacities. And so, you know, we were talking a little bit before you started recording the show about the time that I was spending with my wife 17 months in a camper van as we were trying to drive from Canada to Argentina. And along the way, we met all kinds of fascinating people living on the road, raising children in their RVs. And for me, as a global finance speaker, I would be getting a lot of requests to speak at corporations. So they would be, you know, banks and insurance companies and tech companies. And so they would fly me off to Dubai or to Singapore. And we would end up hanging out with the CEOs of these companies or business executives and spending a lot of time with some really cool, interesting people. But I started to see and wonder, I guess notice, that many of the people that were raising their families in RVs seemed to have the whole life satisfaction thing perhaps a little bit more aligned. Mm. And so many of these people who were highly conventionally successful, in many cases, either weren't spending as much time sleeping, they weren't spending as much time exercising, they weren't spending as much time with their families. And so this affected their life satisfaction. And I'm not to say, of course, that, you know, if you're a corporate CEO, you can't have all these things. You absolutely can. But just by virtue of sometimes the drive that's associated with it and the fact that eventually we end up putting on some blinders and gradually we end up forgetting some of the things that are most important, we can end up dropping some of these really important balls. And so I wanted to emphasize that in the book Balance just as a reminder and then show the behavioral science behind all of this. So it wasn't just one guy, Andrew Hallam's opinion.
All right. I think people love the idea of becoming a millionaire because they think finally then I'll be happy because I'll have the freedom to kick back and do nothing and just travel and do nothing. Do you still consider yourself a man with a job? And is that important to your sense of satisfaction?
Yeah, it is. That sense of purpose is really important. And when we and the research on this is incredibly robust, like when we're working, one of the things that so many people want to do, and I used to think this way when I was in my 20s, I would think, well, it'd be really cool to retire and then I get to do whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky because I did do a job that I really, really enjoyed. So teaching, high school teaching, I taught high school English and high school personal finance, 12 years at Singapore American School, loved it. It was so much fun. But I too wondered, you know, wow, you know, what would it be like if I'm so financially independent, I can just do anything mm-hmm. and never have to work again. But what the research suggests on this is that if we retire early, on aggregate, we die earlier. And the research is robust on this. We need a sense of purpose. And of course, I'm not saying that everybody who retires early is going to die earlier. But on aggregate, this is the case. We lose the sense of identity. We lose a sense of purpose. And so the idea that when you're working full time, and this isn't something that I'm saying everyone should do, work full time until you're 90. I'm saying at some stage, dial back and work part time and do something that you are really passionate about, even if it doesn't pay you a lot of money. This keeps you engaged, keeps us engaged with people who are younger than we are, keeps our minds engaged, keeps us social. And the research on this is so interesting, Michelle, where it suggests that people who end up working longer end up, on aggregate, warding off things like dementia and Alzheimer's mm-hmm. as well. Not that you can't get Alzheimer's and dementia. Anyone could get it. But the odds are lower if somehow you continue working in some capacity. And so for me personally, this is something that I'll always want to do. And I love the idea of like giving talks about personal finance and writing about the subject.
So living your passion. I'm glad you mentioned that you used to teach here in Singapore. So listeners get a sense of the link between Andrew Hallam. He's our guest author today. And we're looking at his book, Balance, How to Invest and Spend for Happiness, Health and Wealth. When you were in Singapore, I'm sure you noticed, Andrew, how much we love our cars here. And you have a whole chapter on stuff or materialism, right? And I thought it was interesting you actually talk about the kind of cars that millionaires surprisingly spend on. So what is your take on how much to spend on a car and your take on conspicuous consumption?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question because when we're looking at what type of car we want, many of us believe that the higher end car will give us a greater driving experience. But something called hedonic adaptability comes into play here. And what that means is when we purchase something new, we upgrade a car or we buy a new phone, this is exciting for a really short period of time. It soon becomes just another phone or just another car. It just becomes a tool. And so it's interesting when we look what Daniel Kahneman says about this. He's a behavioral economist who won a Nobel Prize. And And he talks about happiness as falling under one of two categories, reflective happiness and experiential happiness. Mm. Reflective happiness is essentially what you think about. So if I asked you, Michelle, if you were driving a really, really high-end car, and I asked you, Michelle, are you happier driving that than you would be driving a Honda? Reflectively, just about everybody who's asked this question will say, yes, yes, I am. And it's almost a rationalization of it. Of course, I have to be, right? Mm-hmm. I have to be happier driving this. But based on research, experiential happiness, which is more real, it's more what you're actually experiencing when you're, for example, driving a vehicle. Experiential happiness suggests that, or research on it suggests that, we get used to whatever it is that we own or whatever it is that we're actually driving. So in that case, are we or should we extend ourselves financially to buy something really expensive, like an expensive car, when hedonic adaptability comes into play? One of the things that I did talk about in my book, Balance, is I said, all right, if you would still own that really high-end car if it were invisible, if nobody else could ever see it, then go ahead and buy it. But we have to be really, really honest with ourselves, because many of us are going to buy something that's of high status in part to be seen owning it. And so when we think about recognition, or the highest level of recognition, the highest level in that hierarchy is love and respect. The only way to get love and respect is from other people is to give love and respect. We don't get love and respect from people because we drive a high-end car. If you think about, you know, do you love people more or respect people more who drive expensive cars? No, we don't. So back to that whole point, if the car were invisible, would you still own it? And if the answer is yes, go ahead and buy a high-end car. But be really, really honest with yourself and recognize that aspect of hedonic adaptability and how we get used to the things that we own.
Fascinating. You say in the book somewhere that you were told not to spend more than 5% of your annual salary on a car. Does that still hold for you?
You know, there's no way you could do that in Singapore. And this was actually a guy in the U.S. named Sam Dogan. So what I was doing was I was saying, this is what he says.
Oh,
it wasn't something that it wasn't something that I said, this is a hard, fast rule. This is what I recommend. But he said it. And it's pretty hardcore. But he talked about, you know, vehicles being these massively depreciating assets.
Which they are.
What my wife and I used to do in Singapore is we would figure out what we pay for the vehicle, and then what's the PARF value on the vehicle. Mm. And we would try to figure out what the actual annual depreciation was. And we wanted to make sure that that was as low as possible. So I think at one point, and of course, this is so relative to what the CEO is at a given point in time, COE, sorry, COE, right?
It is COE, yeah.
Got it.
You got the acronym.
Depending on what the price of that is. But I do remember being really proud one time that the depreciation on a vehicle that we had for a four-year period was under 4,000 Singapore dollars per year. And we were really proud of that, because that's fantastic. Challenging to do in Singapore. Yeah. Cars are really expensive.
It really is. So, I mean, when it comes to conspicuous consumption, some say, isn't this part of the human psyche, the need to flex? And some say that's what, you know, is fueling buys in the crypto world or in the metaverse, this idea that you need to flex in order to get the approval from others. What is your take on conspicuous consumption and the relationship between that and happiness?
I think when it comes to whether we get approval from others, we just have to flip to turn the table around and ask ourselves if we truly love or truly respect anyone more or less based on what they have. So I think the answer to that, when we're really honest, is generally no. And we don't love and respect people more or less based on what they actually own. We love and respect them more or less based on how they treat us and how they treat other people. And so, you know, it's weird, Michelle, because we are oddly primitive. Like, we will actually do things to impress other people that don't impress other people. In fact, often alienate other people. So the idea that, you know, I mean, a lot of billionaires in the United States, for example, and around the world, they will consciously not want to show off the high status items that they have in front of other people because it's socially somewhat degrading. You know, to have money thrown in your face, or the fact that somebody else has so much more than you do, it creates envy, it creates jealousy, creates a lot of difficulty. So it's weird how primitive we are, and that we think that people will love and respect us more if we can show them we've got more stuff or better stuff. It actually isn't the case at all. So it's weird how backward we are in terms of human psychology.
Now, what does your book Balance say about the relationship between income and happiness? I think we all know about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you mentioned this, you know, you need a home and you need a roof over your head and you need some level of income before you can reach for those higher levels of meaning in life. But at what level does the correlation between happiness and income sort of peak?
Yeah, that's a great question. Generally speaking, happiness or life satisfaction does improve with income up to a point. And so that point is usually about 50 to 60% higher than the national median income in that given country. So you have a little bit more than your neighbors, which is another thing that's really interesting. You know, we're kind of happier when we got just a little bit more than the people around us. But what the study ends up showing, and the first person that did this was Richard Easterlin, who did the study in the United States, where he looked at a threshold of income as it related to happiness, and he found a leveling off point. Purdue University did an interesting study where they found that that leveling off point currently in the United States is about $105,000 a year of income, and after that point, there wasn't really any added level of reported life satisfaction. What was really interesting, though, is they took it further, and they went, what stage, if we continue to earn more money, does it turn upward or downward? So at what stage could life satisfaction actually improve or drop based on income? And they actually found thresholds in every first world country that they assessed. And it was that beyond a certain point, and that point was different for every single country, but it existed. In the United States, it was beyond $160,000 a year. The level of life satisfaction actually went downward. And so one of the theories behind this is that, well, a couple of theories. One is that researchers do understand that the more materialistic we become, the unhappier we become, because we pursue things, not realizing that things don't augment our life satisfaction. So we buy more things because we don't understand that it's you know, almost this craving that we have to continue to perpetually purchase more things, believing it'll make us happy when it doesn't. So we get into like a vicious cycle. So the more materialistic we become, the less satisfied we become. And two, the second theory is that when you're looking at people with really high incomes, generally they're high stress jobs, or they're jobs and or jobs that require a lot of time. So if they require a lot of time, this is time that these same people are potentially not spending with their loved ones, not spending exercising, not spending sleeping. So those are the theories behind that.
Absolutely fascinating. We're coming up against the news, but I have to ask, what are the habits that are key to helping us keep or make money that this book talks about, Andrew?
I think the best advice I can give people is to actually track what you spend, like get an app and track it, like manually put in what you spend and categorize it. Because by doing that, you'll end up spending less money. It will give you then more money to invest. It will also allow you to spend more money on potentially on experiences, on giving, on helping other people. These are things that add to our life content. Material acquisitions don't necessarily do it. But when we're tracking our money, we can then align our spending with our actual values. We can see where our money is going.
Brilliant, brilliant piece of advice and really well-researched book. Thank you so much, Andrew, for popping by Singapore Radio and joining us live. How to Invest and Spend for Happiness, Health and Wealth. This book is a roadmap to it. It's called Balance. Is the book available on bookshelves yet?
It's available for pre-order on Kinokuniya and Book Depository. It's sold out on Amazon Singapore, so it's actually selling really well. The pre-sales are selling great, so really, really happy about that. I think if you pre-order it on Kinokuniya or Book Depository, you should get it by the 18th of January.
Fantastic. Andrew, appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
He's Andrew Hallam. The book again is called Balance. I'm Michelle Martin. Keep reading.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.